And I actually agree with most of what's been said, that, you know, the funding absolutely needs to be there if we're going to protect public safety. So I think it's important that the committee understand that, you know, how much, you know, we really are spending here. And, you know, the other thing is, just the way our system is with community corrections, we have never, you know, sent all of these people to prison. And we have shown that we don't need to send all these people to prison. And I think that's, you know, part of what I hope to get across with this. Again, the comparison, and the next slide, and it's exactly what we've just been talking about. And I made sure on my notes that I put that I wanted to clarify that we're only talking about state general fund expenditures here. It does not include, the only thing it includes for the county is approximately $71 million in our budget that passes through for supervision and other services. And then I put, it does not include the county's funding for local corrections, because I want to make sure that, you know, we are understanding what this says. But why I keep putting this in is the fact that we have a similar population to Wisconsin. We lock up 13,000 less people than they do, because we do have a system that does not put everybody in prison. So the ones that are coming to prison are people that really need to be there. We have, and out of the general fund, again, a year, it's about $1.2 billion that they spend out of the general fund compared to what we spend. So the important point is in that is that the counties do, and having been at the county for 38 years, I know what they do to keep people out. I know the alternatives to incarceration, to the best practices, and all of this, you know, goes into how come our prison system is like it is today.
We have a question, Commissioner. Hang on 1 second, Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, as I look at the numbers, one of the things that jumps out at me, and I'm sure it's related to what you're saying, is that we obviously are more vigorous about our probation and parole program. Our numbers are almost double what Wisconsin's are. Yet one of the things that my local probation and parole folks tell me is that their caseloads are beyond manageable, and they've had to actually reduce their staff over the last couple of budget cycles. So I'm wondering if you can just comment on that.
Commissioner Stadium.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I absolutely agree that the caseloads are very, very high. We have, in the last, I can't remember which session, we did increase all the funding, the Community Corrections Act funding, the County Probation Officer funding. I still think it needs to be at a higher level than it is. And probation does work, and I think that's exactly right, that we should be focusing resources on, you know, holding people accountable in the community, because they're going to come back there anyway. So, you know, you make a very good point. Okay.
Would you please introduce
my
yourself?
My budget person actually knows the exact amount.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner for Support Services, and I would just like to add one comment to Commissioner Fabian. We did ask for additional funding in the last biennium for probation agents for pass-through money and for the DOC. We did get some of it, but it was short $2 million.
Thank you. Commissioner, continue, please.
You know, again, Minnesota is really different, as I said, from any other state, and I do think that even in this budget crisis, the governor recognized that public safety is you know, paramount, and there was very little cut in terms of pass-through money to the counties and in our budget as well. The next slide, this shows the population projections. In the 2004 through 2007, we had double-digit increases, and it was significant. In the past decade, there's been a 67% increase in people coming to prison. And I think that we've really dealt with that very responsibly in terms of, adding in beds at existing prisons and a number of other things that we looked at. And I think despite what you've heard in some testimony, we have no long-term plans to be building a prison every 4 years. We feel that we have, at this point, depending on if there's major law changes, but if it continues the way it is, we are not anticipating, building in the near future at all. I also added the inmate offense profile just to give you a overview of the type of offenders that are currently in our prisons. And as you see, 50% of the people that are in Minnesota prisons are in there for person offenders. Of that 50%, about 17% of that 50 are sex offenders. Property offenders and drug offenders make up the next categories, but in most other states and the states where I showed you the other charts, the majority of their population are drug and property offenses. So we do not, in general, send too many there.
Can you just hold on 1 second, Commissioner? Representative Reiner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm sorry, just to take you back one slide. When we look at the projections, what's driving the increase? Is it a function of sentencing? Is it a function of demographics?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's all of that. I mean, I think that certainly the we've leveled off in the drug increases back, in 2005, meth was certainly driving it. At this point, that has definitely leveled off. I think DWI offenders are certainly going up. We have 663 now, which, is, I think, a real large number that are in prison. And I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, if one of your staff knows how they just calculated that increase, I'd be curious to know what the factors were, if it was, a derivative of demographic changes or what exactly, because we're looking at, again, almost a 3,000 person increase over the next 10 years. So,
well,
but that, I
mean,
I don't have to have that answer.
You can kind of look at this committee maybe over the last 10 years, and, we've certainly ratcheted up a lot of sentencing, and, that's certainly part of it. Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the numbers and the projection, do you know that if someone is reincarcerated on a technical offense, are they counted in this number? Because we know that the reincarceration rate for technical offenses of probation and parole have been increasing. And so are those folks counted in this chart?
Representative Hilton, yes.
Okay.
Did you say yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Thank you. So do we know what percentage of the folks that are failing on probation and parole are for technical violations, or at some point could you get us that data, or do you know where we would get that data from?
Representative, we are getting that data. I know that is a very big issue, this session, and we're getting all the data in a real good way so you can understand it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling had a question before you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, just you said that 17% of these are sex offenders, and I wanted to know if you meant 17% of the person offenders or 17% of the whole pie chart.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's 17% of the whole population.
Okay.
And actually, the next slide has that kind of laid out for you, if that's helpful.
Okay, thank you.
What we did was, and I included in your handout, there's the individual offense types laid out and information about all of those toward the back of your handout. But I just summarized it on this, you know, looking at the type of people that go to prison. The governing offense is the one that brings them to us, that has the longest time that they're serving. So at person offenders, it's 32% of our entire population. And the average number of prior convictions for the person offender is 5.8. And we have detailed slides, you know, in your handout. I wasn't going to go through all of it, but when you look at it, you'll see that 51% of their priors were prior person offenders, and 51% were prior property offenses. Sex offenders, again, that's 17.6% of our population. They had a prior, average prior convictions of 4.1 prior convictions. And I think 35% of their prior convictions were person offenses, not sexual, and 38% were also prior property offenses. And I think drugs is the one that we've looked at and talked about. And, you know, part of the problem that I had with the conditional release program was that when you look at the drugs, 70% of the people incarcerated were incarcerated for first and second degree, and then there are often plea bargains on the other ones and are incarcerated on the lower offenses that, you know, had been plea bargained down. But they had 7.3 prior convictions before they came to prison. And usually the counties will keep people, try to do alternatives, but in many cases then they come to prison because the treatment options or you know, the terms of probation weren't kept. So again, on that, of their prior offenses, of the 7.3 prior offenses, 54 had prior property convictions, and 44% of their priors were person offenses. So there's such a mix of these people. In most cases, it isn't just a drug offender. It's people who have all kinds of priors in their background. And I think even property offenders, if you look at it, they have had an average of 11.5 prior convictions. And, you know, 52% of those had been prior person convictions, 61 prior property offenses as well. So it isn't really, I went to the wrong one. But it isn't really just a low-risk person that's coming to prison. And I just think it's important that you know it when you're making your decision. And you can see the rest of them. And we do have in your packets the charts that kind of go through all of that.
Let's have a couple questions here, Commissioner. Representative Olin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the question I got is I see that DWI shows up to 7.2%, but under other, we have the DUIs leading to fatalities. So is it safe to say there's actually more than 7.2 DWI related?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, yes, sir.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you have any idea how many of those DUIs leading to fatality cases exist?
Mr. Chair, you know, we don't. It's real hard, you know, depending on what elements we have in our system, and we don't have that one in, and it's real difficult to go back and get it up.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my program, my question deals with the rising chart of prison population as well. Back in the 70s and 80s, was a real push for community corrections in an effort to keep offenders, not high-risk offenders, but keep offenders in the community, cut down on incarceration, cut down on recidivism. It was thought to be a really money savings kind of effort. If I remember correctly, I was involved in some of that. And can you just give me the status of, there's an increase, there's a huge increase from about 2003 on. What is the status of community correction programs now versus the 70s and the 80s?
I have been in community corrections for 38 years before I came here, and I know that at the time I was director there, we certainly added many, many, positions, and all the departments have grown. I don't know how much, I think it saves money, but, because it is more expensive to send them to prison, but again, I don't know what the status is of how much they're being funded. I know they are desperately in need of funding, as well. I think everybody believes it's part of community corrections or part of the state system that it is the best practices, very good type of policy to do what community corrections is doing, and that is providing the services at the local level. And over the years, I know we've developed many, many programs within the community that provide all kinds of services to offenders. And in most cases, and again, I think we need to remember that we really have a low recidivism rate at both the county and the state level. And so it is working. And other states that don't do that and just lock people up, it is cost prohibitive the way they're doing it. And so I think, the status of community corrections is very strong, and I think it's absolutely the way to go in the state corrections field.
Representative Ward? Representative Hawes?
Thank you very much. When I was running for election in the national election, they had Joe the Plumber. And in my election, we had Joe the Reentry Guy. And Joe the Reentry Guy in the St. Cloud area is one of the three places of Faith Initiatives, and Joe Gibbons works in a reentry program that have very few dollars and are very effective. But I feel, just without a lot of wisdom or statistics, that some of the regional centers and some of the areas surrounding the prisons have a great population that's coming out and landing in that area without a lot of support, official support, or without a lot of ability to get into the grants, because they seem to be going mainly to the metro area, and good programs in the metro area, but these two or three organizations just barely exist, and I'm afraid that they're going to disappear now, and there's not going to be that support, and we're going to have a lot of people popping back in. That was my turn to talk. I was wondering if you could comment on that also.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I couldn't agree with you more. We have unbelievable resources in the county, and I think when we brought in the MCOR reentry project, it was exactly those kinds of efforts that we were hoping to fund around the state, and I think, many, many offenders are going back to the outstate Minnesota, and we haven't at this point been giving much funding, or hardly any.
Thank you, Commissioner, and fellow legislators and Chair. What's happening here is that the programs that the money is going into are really terrific programs. But there's more than that area in need. And you can't hardly get anybody interested doing a cakewalk for cons. It just is a real hard fundraising sell. You've got to have some support, and that support needs to be shared, or these areas are really going to eventually get into a problem where people are not going to be able to stay out for very long because they're not getting the support, and the people that are are devoted to this either because of their faith or because of their spirit really need a few pennies to be transferred into that grant account to go that direction. I suspect it's true in all regional centers and all areas surrounding prisons. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hodge, you make a good point tonight, and we've been talking about having one of our meetings devoted, or at least part of it devoted, to reentry programs. And I'm going to ask the Commissioner at some point here to provide us with some data on MCOR so we can, you know, perhaps do, I don't know if we can do a scientific analysis of MCOR and some of the results from, for instance, the network, which we significantly funded last year, and some of the other reentry programs in Duluth, et cetera. But I totally agree that you know, especially in a time of a budget crisis, those kinds of programs that survive in part by grants from the state will probably go away. And I don't think from a public policy perspective that's a good thing, but we're going to have some difficult decisions to make about if we fund those, what don't we fund within DOC.
I thank you for your wisdom, Chair, and it isn't a matter of that program getting too much. It's just a matter of sharing the tragedy, I guess. We sure wouldn't call it sharing the wealth.
Did you have a question on this point? Briefly,
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you received a similar, we got a nice breakdown of all the grants Department of Public Safety makes, and also the contracts that they let. Did we get a similar breakdown for corrections, and if not, are we going to?
Representative Close, you should actually have, I think, Ms. McMahon, is this the Department of Corrections provided you with a list of contracts that exceeded $30,000. I believe that we also provided, did we not provide Representative Cole's list? No. We've got our list.
Mr. Chair, we did send a document over that showed the grants that we do fund and to what.
Yes, you should have that in your handout. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Fabian, on the sex offender stats, it's kind of confusing because we had people in here the other day talking about. We had people in here the other day talking about how few reoffenders there are, and we had the joint hearing, and one of the senators said that we were in too hard on sex offenders about reemployment, and not many of them reoffended. But then you see a statistic about 4.1 prior convictions for sex offenders, and then in almost every single news story you hear of a rapist, they talk about how he or she or a sex abuser was prior convictions or held in this state and that state. Seems like all we hear is about recidivism, but then somebody comes in and says there's very low recidivism in sex crimes. How do you reconcile the two sides? Is there not a high incidence of recidivism in sex crimes?
Chair, Representative Cornish, actually compared to other groups of offenders, the sex offenders do have lower recidivism rates, and the document that I have in your packet that does break it out, we're saying has an average number of 4.1 prior convictions, but if you look, those basically are in the area of prior person, prior property, prior drug. So if you're talking about prior sex offenses, in this one, the people coming to prison, it's 77% of them are on their first sex offense. But, you know, obviously the cases that get civilly committed and that get, you know, very long sentences because of the severe nature of the crime, you know, many of those are really dangerous, entrenched sex offenders that, you know, do have priors. But we average it out.
And in our meeting tonight that hopefully you can attend, I hope we'll be able to go over some of that information with Mr. Benson and others who are working in the sex offender program. So, Representative Lieberman, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly to that point, Commissioner, when you say any prior convictions, are you including misdemeanors in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the gross misdemeanors are also included in that.
Yes, just so. Okay, Commissioner, do you want to continue, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, if I could, I just wanted to make one more comment on the programs. The one especially that Representative Hawes mentioned, they, you know, come to every reentry fair and, you know, all of the different transition things that we have. We have a coalition, and I really appreciate you having, you know, a meeting that would look at all of that, because they've stayed with us year after year and have gotten no funding, and they find places for people that, you know, we can't find places for. So I do think it's real important to start looking at those too. So thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, where am I?
You're on page 8 on operational reduction.
Thank you. You know, I just want to also state that, you know, I know that we're facing a truly huge budget crisis, and that we've got a lot of difficult decisions, but I just want to emphasize that the reality is we really have cut down to just core mandated programs, basically. And further reductions, I firmly believe, will compromise public safety. And in spite of what some other people have been saying, we have taken significant cuts in the past 6 years. And we have made major changes in absolutely everything we do. We've cut over $85 million. We have eliminated a number of positions, and at the same time, we've had the biggest increase in population in the department's history. And I can assure you that we spent many hours trying to come up with a responsible way to look at a 5% cut to our budget, which would be $46 million. Every alternative that we considered was to the point that it would either endanger public safety or correction staff in our facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get back to the slide that we were just on. In the 0405 section, $36.7 million reduction. What's listed here is missing the short-term offenders. I just want members to know that that is one of the large reductions that they...
Where are you, Representative Houston?
On the second...
Okay.
On the second block, it says 0405, $36.7 million, and then it lists what the reductions were. This is when the short-term offender took place, so that was a significant portion of that. And then also what's not listed out is there was a large amount of cuts to community services. And I actually have the spreadsheet here of what the cuts were to, you know, the community corrections kinds of things as well. So that is also what makes up this $36.7 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they were bigger cuts. This is only operational cut stuff, and you're absolutely right. There were huge cuts to the counties that included the short-term offenders that passed through money to the CPA counties and CPO counties. In this overhead is only cuts to our operational. So our budget itself, when you look at all of the cuts that were taken, was more significant than the $85 million. I only put in the ones that affected our department operationally. it obviously affected our department, you know, to have pass through money to community corrections cuts because, you know, they can't, they're going to have to send more people to prison when they can't manage them. So, but I really wanted to make sure that, you know, we weren't doing exactly that. So this is just operational cuts to the DOC.
Mr. Chair.
Mrs. Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make it clear because, you know, I was involved in the short-term offender debate and discussion at the time. And so there was discussion about reducing the amount of money that the Department of Corrections was receiving for these short-term offenders because they were no longer going to have the population. And so when we're talking about the amount of dollars that they did or didn't get, we have to remember that they were no longer getting those offenders sent to them. And so there was a direct reduction in the number of people as part of that as well.
Commissioner, are you, is this the time that we can do, that you want to discuss per diems and other things like that, or you have some slides later that you're going to get into?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to just finish the budget,
okay,
and then we can get into everything if that's all right. All
right.
Okay. I guess, again, we're really unique in the agency in that our populations are driven by the courts. We have no control over our intake for prison or for the field. We have no waiting lists, and we can't reduce hours or close a prison. Every day, you see the people that are committed to us, and they're violent rapists and murderers and gang members. And while the prison sentence may seem like an ending for an immediate problem by removing them from the community, it's just the beginning of many years in the Department of Corrections where the staff deal with these offenders 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And unlike other agencies, we must be staffed 24/7. Unlike other agencies, intensive community service in the fields continues nights, weekends, and holidays. Our supervision agents, along with county agents, manage and supervise over 147,000 people out in the community, and they are daily put in harm's way. I guess the consequences for reductions in our budget are also very different than what happens in other agencies. In most agencies, a lack of adequate personnel and resources won't result in someone getting stabbed in the back with a shank or getting beaten up or getting shot on an unannounced visit out, you know, in the middle of the night. That we and county agents do every single day of every single week. And unless you've worked in a prison and supervised these dangerous offenders on the street, I think it's really hard for people to comprehend what our working environment is. So we've got just a real short clip that we just want to show you to make you see that real people are working in our prisons and supervising our offenders on the street, and they are putting their life in life and death situations every single day of every single shift, and they deal with the most dangerous and desperate people. I think there really are consequences, and I don't think we ever think about it. We come in here and we answer all these questions, and we should, because you are our oversight committee. And, you know, I guess my point is I'm really, you know, when we're not here, there's all this work that's going on, and it's really, really horrendous work in many cases. And people are, you know, in danger all the time of being harmed, of being harassed, degraded, and sued. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that's been in corrections for a number of years that hasn't had something happen. I've had my car firebombed, I've been getting threats, and almost everybody does do that, whether you're in the prison or out in the field. The governor's budget recommendation reflects his concern that DOC funding be adequate to sustain appropriate staffing levels for our staff and to ensure community safety. At this point, I would just like to turn it over
Commissioner, before you turn it over, can we just, we have a few more questions that have come up since you started talking. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the light went off when you mentioned a while ago gang members. Has the fact that there's an increase in gang members in this state over the last, I don't know how many years you want to say, but has that had an effect on how many prisoners are actually showing up in prison?
Chair, Representative Olin, absolutely it has. And it's also had a huge effect on what's going on, you know, in the cell blocks and, you know, even out on the streets. And, you know, we work our intensive OSI, Office of Special Investigation. We have intelligence agents in our you know, every one of our prisons, and one of the huge things that they do is look at the gang activity, and it's on the streets, and it you know, flows from the streets into the prison. So we're always trying to manage putting you know, breaking up the gang leaders and putting them in different places, getting them out of the state, taking a horrendous prisoner from somebody else to break it up. So it's you know, it's a really, really significant problem.
Representative Olin.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So when you look at the numbers between 2000 and 2008, part of that increase is probably because of the gang increase. I know it's been down in the metro area, it has increased to rural Minnesota a lot more in the last few years. Is that safe to say?
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely it is. And it is all over the state.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my traditional behavior, I may have jumped ahead of myself a tad bit because I saw the double bunking thing up there, so I wanted to talk about that. So I may have another question later, but I also serve on the policy committee, and it's always good to see you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And one of the questions when we were talking about the report that was due to us, and we were going through that, and one thing that was mentioned in there is the increase in incidences to either staff or to prisoners, and they had talked about how it is related to an increase in gang members in prison. But I was a little taken aback when I asked, and I forget who the staff member was, I was taken aback when I asked them, what are you doing proactively to kind of talk about this amongst the inmates? And he said, well, we separate them. You know, we have, you know, we put them, you know, we mix them, but separate, and it was just kind of convoluted. I guess what I'd like to know is, do you have a program that upon intake or some sort of class or something that you talk about expectations or what you're going to be looking for? I mean, I'm being naive. I have visited, and I am going Friday to Oak Park Heights in Stillwater. And maybe I am being naive about prison culture. I have never been. But I'm just wondering, do you have some sort of proactive program that, you know, you talk with them about when they get in?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, it isn't specifically for gangs, but everybody that comes in at St. Cloud in the reception center, they're assessed. And they look at what they need. A lot of these gang members are chemically dependent. A lot of them have mental health problems. A lot of them, you know, haven't graduated from high school. So we do it's like a 45-day assessment, looking at their risk and, you know, look back at their records, look at intelligence context. So basically, we do look at what kind of an individual plan that they can have. We don't have a specific program just for gang members. We really don't want them all together. We, you know, I mean, that's good. But, you know, and we really do have some good luck with changing some of the behavior. And obviously, there are people that are not going to change. But even gang members, we've had, you know, really good success. They get in a CD program and they make success. We have some real intense programs that look at, you know, clear thinking and, you know, non-criminal, you know, looking at a different way to reason. We do a whole lot of stuff with restorative justice, so they, and we bring in, like, the mother of young men who have been killed in the gang violence, and they talk about how that's affected them. And there's all kinds of people that come into the prison and put on different seminars for them as well. So we absolutely are looking at dealing with, you know, what the core issues are.
Representative Statham.
One brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. You mentioned intake and assessment. One question that I have, let's say there was an inmate that had never, in their assessment, they had never had any sort of chemical dependency issue and did not have a mental health issue, but it was more of a crime of desperation. I know, I'm just trying to think of another reason, but would they be required to take chemical dependency classes and or any other mandatory programs that you have? So if nobody had any sort of mental health or issues or chemical dependency, would they still be required when they're in custody to participate in a chemical dependency class?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. We have a very limited resource of who we can provide chemical dependency treatment for and who we can provide sex offender treatment for. And so we really have criteria about who gets treatment, at what. And it wouldn't make sense to treat somebody who doesn't have a chemical dependency problem.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, again, in the study that we heard about increase in incidences on staff, and you commented that we don't always think about the officers and the job, the dangerous job that they're doing, and I agree. It's very, very dangerous. But I also think that it's very dangerous for the other staff that works as well. And I'm curious as to if you recommended to the governor the cut in the pension for the non-guard staff.
Commissioner Hilton, I wonder if we, just in terms of process, if we want to have the commissioner walk through the budget book next, and that's when that reduction will come up with you, because I think this is going to be a lengthy discussion. Maybe it's pulled off till we start the budget books, and that may be today or maybe Tuesday. That's a good question, and we want an answer. So, Representative Haas?
Maybe just off that, not getting to the retirement, but let's just get to the happening when the staff is beat up, the teacher is beat up, the guard is beat up, and the police officer is beat up or harassed or abused. Are all those the same crime? And I've had guards tell me and teachers tell me that they feel that the convict has no fear of this and they're not being punished adequately. Could you comment on that, please?
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner, thank you.
Mr. Chair, a representative, when a staff is assaulted, we take it very seriously. We always refer to the county attorney, and we ask that they vigorously prosecute it. There is in the statute now language that says if a correctional officer is attacked, that it's a felony. I'm not sure about the teachers. I'd have to check on the teachers. What the statute also says is it is supposed to run consecutively, that they cannot get out of, that they can't serve the new offense at the same time they're serving for what they're in there. What has been happening, however, is that judges have allowed them to serve it concurrently so that offenders are actually saying to officers that, it doesn't matter if I get no more time, I'm in here anyway. So I think, that really has to change, and we're very, very concerned about that. But the county attorneys are in all of our jurisdictions, take it very seriously, and do go forward with the prosecution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I think something needs to be adjusted so that that the prisoner recognizes that if he's going to do this type of thing that's on page 12, that he's going to have to feel some pain for doing it.
No, I really appreciate the fact that you're expressing this concern in so will they.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Did you, Griffin Ola?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question just for clarification so everybody understands. When you say county attorney, and the county attorneys that these cases get referred to are always the county that the jail, the prison's actually in, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Just a quick follow-up. Do these counties... Thank you. Do these counties receive any reimbursement from the state for any up with these extra cases? Because I realize that they do inherit extra cases from having those prisoners.
Mr. Chair, no, they don't. I think, you know, one of the things that they talk about balancing out is the fact that most of the economic growth in those counties, you know, rely on the prison, jobs. So, but, you know, again, if there were funding, I would like to see the counties get reimbursed for it.
Mr. Sergey, do you have anything to add to that, Representative Owen's question?
Mr. Chairman, you know, I believe Washington County still may receive funding for the attorneys. At least at one time they did. I don't know if that was taken away or...
Mr. Chair...
Because of the two prisons that were in that...
Right. I believe they used to, but they don't anymore. We've had a lot of cuts over the years.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I want to go back to Representative Haas's comments a little bit on this whole issue of assault. Is there a stereotype or some kind of a list of characteristics that would be common to the inmates who actually get involved in an assault? Is there a...
Commissioner?
You psychologist back there? If I might respond, for the record, my name is Lynn Dingle. I'm the deputy commissioner over the facilities, and I spent 33 years of my career in prison. And there may not be a target that you look at, but we get to know in the prison very, very quickly those offenders that we need to watch out for because they are assaulted towards staff.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, pardon me, Commissioner, or anyone else that would answer. There's a comment, I think Representative Haas had commented that there needs to be some more significant consequences that need to be apparent, and need to be early, and they need to be clear, and they need to happen, and I agree with that. What about, is there a carrot and stick approach? What is being done on the positive side? To discourage assault, is there anything happening in the prison culture that is designed to really get at this issue and use some peer pressure in the prison culture to not have that happen?
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, there are numerous programs that we have going on in the prison. Actually offered to the general population. Anger management is one of them that comes to mind quickly, about teaching offenders how to resolve their differences outside of using physical violence. And I guess it may not be conceived by them or perceived by the offenders to be a positive way of handling it, but what we'll do is move offenders that are assaulted to a higher custody level, such as our Oak Park Heights Maximum Security Prison, where their movement and ability to program is severely curtailed. We see that as positive, or the staff do, that people are moved to a higher custody level so that they're not allowed to stay in, say, a medium or lower custody facility and have more freedom of movement and ability to assault.
One more question. You know, I guess I'm thinking those are programmatic kinds of things. I'm thinking of kind of like in schools, what they do. Sometimes they have a very disruptive kid. What they do is they do a mentoring. They pair them up with another student. They do some things to try to work inside the kid's culture, not just send them off to a psychologist or to a program or to this. Is there any way that you're trying to inside of the relationships that prisoners have? Is there some way that we could begin to use some peer pressure to address the issue?
Deputy Commissioner Dingle.
Members of the committee. Actually, we do use mentors in many of our programs. Unfortunately, the most assaultive offenders are not willing or cooperative to utilize some of the programs that we have or use a mentor. But what we often see, though, is if an offender, for instance, a chemically dependent offender, has other behaviors as well, And once they've completed their chemical dependency, it addresses their criminal behavior as well, and that's where we see results. We have several programs throughout our facilities, a violence reduction project, where we have outside volunteers that come in and manage that. We do the best we can, but unfortunately, those that are assaulted towards staff really, they're just not willing to cooperate or willing to change. They're just a tough group to handle.
Representative Ward, and then maybe we should go back to the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if there was any legislation or statute enacted already to talk about the commission talk about as a prisoner commits a crime, but their new crime can't serve that concurrently. I just found out from Mr. Duber that it's currently a statute 609.2322, is that correct, Mr. Duber? Okay. 223. That is already currently in the books?
My understanding, yes.
So, but the judiciary isn't following that process?
I lost you somewhere. Can you just rephrase your question?
Sorry.
There's a current statute that disallows a prisoner from serving its new sentence concurrently, as we're talking about. And so, I wonder why the judiciary isn't following that, or why. I know you don't have that, but I wanted to point that out. I guess I wanted to point that out, make that comment, that there's already something in the books dealing with that, and that it's just not being followed.
Mr. Siebel, do you want to comment on this, or do you have something to add?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted it, be known that there's state statute dealing with this already that isn't being followed.
Mr. Chair, let me.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward. Regardless of what the statute books say, judges do what they want to do. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, having worked at both Oak Park Heights and Stillwater, which is in one county, so we have one county attorney dealing with the results of our prison cases, our county attorney has assured us that any time it's an assault on our staff, no matter what level it is, that he is going to go forward with that. And you are correct. It's already in the law. It should be served consecutive. They should not get jail credit for it, but we do have some judges that don't follow that. Our county attorneys try to remind them of that through the process, but we have had that happen. And yes, the staff are very well aware of that when that happens, and it's not good. They don't feel supported when that occurs.
Okay, Commissioner Sabian, did you want to show this clip now? Or is that you want to do? And how long is it, just so I can know for time purposes?
Real quick.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to start with the double bunking issue. In your handouts is a chart of the percent of multiple occupancy that we have in each of our prisons. The only prison that we have that is totally single-celled or single-room occupied is our maximum security prison at Oak Park Heights. That's by design, and that's evidence-based practice. You do that with your high-level offenders. At the rest of our facilities, we have varying types of multiple occupancy, such as double bunking. We have quads, triples. We have dorms. Our challenge incarceration program is a dorm setting. The first slide that you're looking at here is actually at the Stillwater facility. It's cell hall B, double bunking. And the other facility that we recently started double bunking was at St. Cloud. These are higher custody level. These are close custody facilities. Evidence-based practice would tell you that you don't double bunk at those custody levels. However, we were in the need to do that, so we did. What happened was in Stillwater, at St. Cloud, it's their intake facility. So those offenders that are double bunked actually move to the St. Cloud facility very quickly compared to other facilities. Stillwater has a pretty stagnant population. People that come to Stillwater tend to stay there for long periods of time. So when we double bunked in B West, we had a huge spike of incidents, discipline issues. up to about 90 per month in that one cell block alone. Typically, after an incident that's large enough, we will lock down a facility or a unit. We will lock it down, search it for weapons, contraband, things like that. And we did notice a reduction in the incidents after a lockdown. However, it spiked right back up shortly after that. So what we did was start reducing the number of double bunk cells that we had in that cell block for the safety of our staff and actually for the safety of the other offenders. As we reduced those double bunk cells, we did notice a drop in the number of incidents per month in that cell block. And they ranged from about going from about 90 a month at the peak down to about, about 60 on the average. And there's ups and downs in that.
Representative, let's go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me, when you work on double bunking, do you attempt to rotate the schedule so that maybe one is, you know, working or doing programming in the night and one is doing it in the day? I've seen other programmings where they attempt to schedule things so that the people aren't in the cell as much at the same time. So do you have that practice, or did you find that when you double bunked, the people were in the cell a lot of the time together?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's a very good question. To the extent that we can do that, we do try to program them out of their cells as much as we can. We can't do it into the evening. We simply don't have the staff, plus we lock them in at 10 o'clock. But what we have done is try to schedule them out of their cell at different times when, and depending on the unit, and in B-West there's about 360 average offenders. So there is a recreation schedule, visiting, meals, and they do get rotated out. But they do end up spending from about 10 o'clock on to the next morning in the double cell with each other. What we do as far as how we place people in double cells together, it's a fine line between two people that aren't going to get along and assault each other and two people that are going to get along way too well, and you don't want that kind of activity as well. So it's a fine line. We try to make sure that we keep the racial balance of the facility in itself also balanced in each living unit. If we have opposing gang members, we have to track that. We're not going to put the leaders of two opposing gang members in the same cell. That probably wouldn't work out so well. So it's a more complex issue. It's a good point. We've tried to manage it, and we try to tell people, you know, if you two can't get along, if we try everything else and it results that they're saying, well, I'm going to hit this guy in order to get out of this cell, we try to work with that and say, find someone that you think you can live with. But the staff in the unit know these people really, really well, and they know who should be together and who shouldn't be together. We don't want racial groups to always be together in the same cell. We want to make, you know, mix it up. So it's a complex problem, and it's one that we are continually dealing with and continually moving people from cells because of the issues that result.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember what state it was, but I did go to a conference at NCSL where they took us to a prison where they were constantly having one of the two of the double bunk cells working. And so they actually had, you know, a first shift of work, a second shift of work, and a third shift of work. And they were cycling people through so that they could have two folks in the same cell and they were not in the cell locked up at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I'm going back. You said in Stillwater you have about 90 incidents a month in that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was at the peak when we first double bunked that unit. That was the
okay.
Peak.
And Mr. Chair, what is that now?
It averages about 50 per month. You know, but that there is fluctuations depending on gang activity and things like that. But it has reduced drastically.
Sure. And then you commented that, you know, when there is a significant of enough incident, then you do a lockdown of that area and you do a weapons and contraband search. How often do you find weapons or contraband?
Mr. Chair, nice. Representative, we find weapons often. We do routine random lockdowns just for that purpose of clearing out contraband. I would say that typically the most we get out of those lockdowns is excessive property, that they have more property than they should have. They, you know, they're storing food that they shouldn't, things like that. But on occasion, we do find weapons. We also have an investigative unit that can monitor mail, monitor phones. And they will tell us when they are hearing or if inmates are telling them that there's issues going on in a cell block, and we will lock it down preventatively and do that search for weapons.
One more question. You alluded to it a little bit, but I guess with the amount of security that's there, how does the stuff get in there?
Mr. Chair, representatives, it's amazing what offenders can do. We have metal detectors at Stillwater, all through the main corridor, leaving the industry unit, leaving the unit, work areas. They are unbelievable in what they can manage. For instance, when I worked at the Oak Park Heights facility, we have a video that we used for training, and it was in the visiting room, and we watched as a mother passed contraband to her son. And I watched that video probably 10 times before I could even see her passing it behind her back to the inmate who secreted it in his rectum. And we're looking at the tape and we can hardly see that. They are just very, very good at what they do. All of these weapons are made out of things. If we took away everything in their cell and their life that they could make a weapon out of, they'd have cells with nothing in them. They're just ingenious if they could only take that creativity and use it to a positive use. What I'm going to present now, I'm going to narrate this. It's a short video clip of various incidents in our prisons. And as we go along, I will try to explain what's going on, where it's happening, and what part of the screen to watch. What I will tell you is the first beginning of this, we use a controlled movement system in most of our prisons, and we currently have some continuous improvement process going on at the rest of the prisons to look at a controlled movement. And what this means is that, for instance, at Stillwater, you don't ring a bell and every cell block empties into the main corridor to go wherever they're going. We systematically pick units and schedule them to move in smaller numbers to wherever they need to go, whether it be work, whether it be a religious activity, visiting, work assignments, whatever it can be. So the first beginning of this clip is at Stillwater. The officer at that door has to manually lock and unlock that cell block door every time there is movement. So we'll begin the video clip, and I'll try to narrate it for you. Technical difficulty.
While you're figuring that out, maybe I'll just ask for. You got it?
Okay. This is in a cell block in Stillwater. That officer's at the door controlling. This is a dining hall, half of the dining hall at Stillwater. We have a concrete block wall that goes down the very middle of that dining hall in order to separate offenders and systematically move them in and out of dining. These are offenders that are waiting in line to get their meals. You see the guy saying, "Hi, Mom." This is another controlled movement out of one of our living units. Typically, we're moving probably 250 guys at a time, even with our controlled movement. This is an incident at Oak Park Heights where they were just doing a routine move of an offender back into a cell, and watch closely. Unprovoked, that offender headbutted another staff. This is at our West City facility. Watch the upper right-hand corner of your screen. An offender has just mixed up hot water and honey and thrown it in the face of an officer, and now several offenders are in the corner kicking him and beating him. You will see out of the left-hand side of the screen, and an officer will respond. We use an incident management system in all of our facilities that makes sure that you have sufficient response before someone gets involved in an incident where they are outnumbered. The officer was spraying a chemical irritant on those offenders. Some offenders, it has no effect on them anymore. You will soon see the officers responding out of the left screen as they go in, and they will break up those offenders. this again was a totally unprovoked attack. This is in Stillwater Prison. What you're seeing down the bottom left-hand corner of your screen are two offenders beating up the guy in the middle, and apparently this was over some kind of gang violation that the gang members called on this guy. He didn't or did do something he shouldn't have or didn't do something that they told him to do, so they are assaulting him. This is also at Stillwater, and watch the top, not the very top, but the second to the top tier, and you will see one offender trying to throw another offender over the railing. Again, this is Stillwater. This is an assault that's occurring. This one involved a weapon, which you'll see in a second, but this isn't our double bunk unit. You can see that there's double bunks in some of those cells. And what happens is that the staff will respond from both sides of this tier here, but at some point, which I'll point out to you, the offender actually, with a weapon, turns on the staff. There you see an officer from the right-hand side coming in. They're spraying irritant. There's barely room for more than two people to be side-by-side on these tiers. You'll see staff now and some of the offenders coming again back from the left-hand side of the screen. Now this gentleman, watch him. He's got the weapon, and he's trying to toss it down to the next tier to get it removed. This is the old segregation unit in Stillwater, which thankfully we were able to build a new seg unit. This is flooding. Due to the age of the facility, they could plug their toilets and their sinks and then run their water and completely flood out the unit. And if somebody's on the top tier doing that, it's spilling down over all the tiers onto the floor. It's the only unit I know that we had raincoats for staff to wear. This is a fire back in the old SEG unit at Stillwater as well. They could spark papers, or they could spark their electrical outlets with the papers in their cells, which was not very much. Then they would throw those items on fire out onto the cell block, or onto the tier floor. This next slide is a picture of the officer that you saw at the Rush City facility that had the honey and the water thrown in his face, the burns on his face, and then he was assaulted. On the left-hand side of the cliff, that's an officer. His shirt used for evidence because an inmate threw urine and feces on him. This is not an uncommon occurrence, unfortunately. These are contraband weapons that we've collected over the years. As we talked about earlier, we do random shakedowns, try to find them. But these are examples that we actually keep and use for training of new officers. This clip shows you, inmates can get legal mail or privileged mail, and we are only allowed to open that mail in front of the offender. This inmate's mother got her hands on an attorney's envelope and mailed in to him in the institution, it was worth $12,400 worth of cocaine. The cocaine was in flat packets in between papers that were glued together, so if you were just going to hand the envelope over, you would not have felt that or noticed that, which typically, we're able to open the mail. Because it was legal, we had suspicion on this one, and our investigators caught this on the phone monitoring, and so we pulled that, and when we opened it up, you can see the cocaine that was caught.
Representative Holstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking back at that video, some of that was, very, very concerning. Most of it was. Can you tell me, I noticed that the prisoners have weapons. Are the guards, do they have any kind of weapons at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, our staff are outfitted with chemical irritant. We do not allow weapons in our facilities. That's the best practices, again, that you bring a weapon inside a prison. That's one more thing that a firearm, one more thing that offenders can get out of your control and use against you. So we do not allow firearms. So our staff are, you know, they have the gloves for safety, they have handcuffs, they have chemical irritant, and that's kind of the progression of what we use in the prison.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the time? I mean, when you're watching it happen, it seems like it's forever, which may be a shorter period of time. But what is the timeline or the average number of minutes that it takes for you to get these situations back under control?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's a very good question. Depending upon the physical plant of the facility, it varies. But I have always been impressed that we've had a recent incident that we had, the response was less than 3 minutes. So it depends. We have what we call squads. They're the first team of responders, and they are kind of moving around the facility, and they will be located in areas where we may tend to have more problems because more offenders are grouped, such as our dining halls. So it really depends on the physical plant. And then, it's just amazing the response. I am always impressed when I see the staff responding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I need a motion from a member to approve the minutes of February 10th. Commissioner Lesch moves the minutes of February 10th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. I think at this point, rather than getting into the budget, since we only have 5 minutes left, that I hope we was a very good presentation, gave us an overview that allowed members to ask some specific questions about policies and inside the institutions, but on Tuesday we need to get into the specifics of the budget, so I hope members will concentrate on your budget books, and if you need any information between now and Tuesday that you're not seeing in your budget books, please notify Ms. McMahon, and we will get that information to you. Reminder that this afternoon we're meeting at tonight at 6:30 in room 200 here at the SOB. That's the joint sex offender hearing with Representative Hillstrom, do you want to say something about your tour coming up?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to remind the committee that you've all received an email that we are making a trip. I believe it's to Stillwater and Oak Park Heights this Friday. You're all invited. We'll be riding a prison bus to take a look at the very facilities you saw in the video.
Is there any other questions or business before the committee? This is adjourned.